The Con Guy Show, the official program of theconguy.com, is heard on the We Be Geeks Collective and on sci-fi.radio.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Doctor Who is all about change. For almost 59 years, the show has gone through many regenerations.
One thing always consistent is a sense of hope and wonder across all space and time.
It's the dawn of a new era, and your friends at our Station Who will be here to cover everything to come this year and beyond. Please rate and subscribe to our show wherever fine podcasts are found.
Khan, you've got Genesis, but you don't have me. You are going to kill me, Khan. You're going to have to come down here. You're going to have to come down here.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me. As you left her. Marooned for all eternity in the center of a dead planet. Buried alive.
We're the Con Guys, and this is the Con Guy Show, coming to you straight from the nerdy heart of Hollywood, California.
And this is Jim with theconguy.com.
She's been here with theconguy.com.
Katie here, aka the Con Girl.
Zordon did not want five teenagers with attitude.
My name is Derek Sam.
I'm Danae Sams, and that's my brother.
We are your home for news, opinions, and interviews from the world of Comic-Cons and fandoms, your ultimate insiders for all things
In 1982, the Starship Enterprise came out of mothballs and, some say, saved the Star Trek universe in the epic and still awesome Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, a film which deserves us to talk about it here. 40 years later, we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of this most epic of Star Trek films. My name is Jim. I am one of your co-hosts here on The Con Guy Show. And with me tonight, let's talk. Derek, why don't you introduce yourselves?
Yeah, my name is Derek. I am a regular on The Con Guy Show, a contributor to theconguy.com. And I'm excited to be here to talk about one of my all-time favorite franchises, a big part of my childhood, with an expert.
Speaking of the expert, Tom, please give us, introduce yourself and give us a little bit of your credentials and why we are coming to you to help
you
us.
Know why, the why legacy you mean Star expert? Waka waka. Hi, Dr. Thomas Parham. I teach communication and media studies at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida. And I am a Trexpert because my doctoral thesis was about Star Trek The Next Generation. And it was published by McFarland. The summer before the pandemic hit us all.
You got a PH Enterprise D.
Hey, Tom, can people find your book somewhere?
Yes, they can find it on Amazon. And I recommend the digital version, which is a lot cheaper, because academic books are not priced to sell to a large crowd. So.
But also, didn't you, what's the game, the online game that you wrote as well that you were helping with? The Star Trek game?
Well, I wrote the questions for Star Trek Scene It, which was produced by Mattel and Screen Life years ago.
Oh, yeah, just that.
Just wrote Star Trek Scene It, that was all.
Yeah.
Yeah, no big deal. That's why I've never played that game with you.
I'm credited on the DVD.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. So we are going to talk about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And I'm going to throw it to you first, and then we'll get some deeper context with Mr. Blurred PhD over here. Who's this, Tom?
This is Daisy. She heard your voices and wanted to take a peek.
Aww.
So she'll get bored with you and go back to her side of the couch.
I have a sleeping dog in the bed behind me, too. Let me pick this up and see if you guys see it. Well, that's Dublin, a great big pit bull that all he does is sleep. But he'll probably start barking because if he sees you staring at your computer for more than 30 minutes, he starts barking at you. It's kind of like a natural get off the computer alarm. But so I think, Derek, you just saw Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. You rewatched it recently. And as a Star Trek fan, I just want to give me your high level thoughts about how this film holds up.
Well, I mean, granted, there is the nostalgia factor because any big Star Trek fan would have been into this back in the day. This movie is older than I am. I'm going to put that out there. And the original series crew members, the movies with the original series crew anyway, they kind of like had just always existed in my mind. I think I might have seen number 6 in theaters, and all the others, I just was not aware of them coming out because it was either before I was born or I was too young to know the difference. So this is one of those that, like, as a very small child, I had seen parts of this and the others piecemeal. Same way with the original Star Wars trilogy, and it was not until I was older that I actually could see stuff in order and understand what was going on a little better. I just knew that it was a space adventure, and my family liked it, and so therefore so did I. And of course, The Next Generation became a much bigger part of my childhood because I was a very small child when that series started, and so it was a huge deal to me when it ended later because that was, like, you know, a big chunk of my childhood. But this one in particular, I think, just for one, as you already mentioned, it really got the franchise really going. Like, you had the motion picture that came out and it reunited the cast, but it didn't have the same kind of love yet until this movie came out, and then it merited a whole lot more sequels. If the second movie had not been as good as this one was, I don't know if we would have had as many others. It's not like today where studios will just milk everything they can out of a franchise, whether the movies are good or not. But still, like, there's the nostalgia factor. There's the fact that it was influential in, like, really getting the franchise going as a movie franchise and not just a has-been TV show, you know, one that we used to like, but it actually made it in film, in theaters. And the other factor is just thematically, this movie is very strong. I think it's very well structured. It speaks to very universal themes, which is what has always brought me to love Star Trek anyway. I actually had a professor in college who said, like, he thought this was one of the greatest films ever made. And he would talk about the reasons why. And you've got, like, some of the characters, like Khan in particular, almost has this Shakespearean vibe about him with his obsession with revenge. And so much about, you know, it's Kirk is facing old age and dealing with what it means to face these changes in life, and then meeting his son, and what it would mean to leave a legacy, and, like, this whole theme of, like, facing death and what does that mean for us, and what do we find in us to really face death with courage. There's so much I could talk about besides, like, just how moving it is, because everybody, I mean, if you didn't figure it out already, we are going to be spoiling this 40-year-old movie during this podcast.
I guess we should say, yeah, that, yeah. Especially that there's a big moment in this film that we're going to kind of dissect a little bit. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But
yeah, that's all the warning you get. You should know better by now anyway. but yeah, like, Spock's sacrifice is incredibly moving. And he was such a beloved character. And it was like, it's hard for me, growing up with these films the way I did, to really understand the full impact of that, because it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I went through and watched all of the original series in order and then watched the movies like this to really get it. And even so, like, I already knew what was coming. So I'm never going to get that same experience. Just like I'm never going to get the shock finding out, you know, who Darth Vader really is.
Who is it?
Always that way.
I still don't know.
But anyway, yeah, you know, sometimes I think some of the writers didn't either when they were doing the original trilogy. The prequel trilogy, that is. Anyway, we should move on to the expert.
Okay. Well, like, so Tom, I'm going to throw it to you, but with this little tidbit that came from the New York Daily News. This is what they had to say about Star Trek II. Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan is the movie that should have been made the first time around. Can you, before you talk, tell us about your high level, what you think of the film, give us some context about the first film and why this film is the film that's, many say, kind of saved the franchise.
Oh, there's so many things to say. to make a long story shorter, in 1976, Paramount was going to launch a fourth television network. The flagship series would be Star Trek Phase Two. Leonard Nimoy was going to appear only in the pilot. A younger Vulcan would replace him as science officer on the ship. Will Decker and Ilea would be regulars on the show, and the rest of the original crew would be back. At the last minute, they got cold. The powers that be behind this new network, including names like Barry Diller, who would go on to launch Fox within the next decade. Basically, they got cold feet. And so the decision was to basically take the 2-hour pilot for Star Trek Phase Two and turn it into a theatrical feature. The problem with don't get me wrong, I have a special place in my heart for Star Trek, the motion picture, the director.
Beecher.
The director's edition. Here's the problem. One, the plot line is recycled from, depending on how you count, from approximately 4 different classic Star Trek episodes, has elements of them. But more important, Robert Wise, who won Oscars for directing The Sound of Music and West Side Story before that, Paramount took director's cut away from him because they had to make the December release date in time. Some of the effects weren't fully finished, and as a result, the director's edition is shorter than the theatrical release and much shorter than the home video release, which inexplicably was longer. So with story-wise, you need the events of Star Trek I to happen for Spock to be who he is in Star Trek II. Star Trek I made money, but not enough money for Paramount. They fired Roddenberry from his own franchise.
That's the remarkable part. Like, Gene Roddenberry was forced out of the Star Trek franchise.
His title on the film on Star Trek II Beyond is executive consultant. And of course, he gets the created by, based on Star Trek created by Gene Roddenberry. But here's the biggest problem. Sometimes a phenomenon outgrows its creator, especially when decades have passed. One could argue the same thing about Star Wars. That's a different discussion, a much longer podcast.
Yeah.
But I think that was probably one of the best things that could happen is that they brought Paramount brought in somebody new, producer-wise, Harv Bennett, and then also somebody new for the director, or fairly new for the director, Nicholas Meyer, who had written the time travel movie Time After Time, which is a great movie if you haven't seen it.
I like that movie,
So, and Nicholas Meyer would be in and out of the classic movies from 2 through 6.
Okay.
So, he brought some fresh blood and a new take in. And one of the things he did was watch all 79 episodes of the original series. And he said, this guy, Space Seed, Khan, we need to bring him back. And then, because he has a grudge against Kirk. And most importantly, it is very Moby Dick-like. In terms, there is an actual line of dialogue, which is a complete paraphrase of Moby Dick. I love it. Ricardo Montalban is chewing scenery as if there's no tomorrow.
That's great.
And Shatner's keeping up with him. And one of the brilliant aspects is the two actors never share physical space.
You would never know that
because of the way that their conflict plays out. But I love this movie.
It didn't really occur to me watching it that they're like never in the same room together.
Never in the same physical space. I just watched the director's edition to celebrate the actual 40th anniversary a couple weekends ago.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think you mentioned Moby Dick. I think it's on the shelf there when Chekhov is going
through
the Botany Bay. And so you get the idea. He's been reading it and he's taking inspiration from it. And if, is quoting or paraphrasing it later.
Go ahead.
One more thing. Another problem from Star Trek One, they kind of pretend that the characters haven't aged.
Yeah.
And that's problematic. Yes, Kirk has been promoted to Admiral, but he finds a way to take command of the Enterprise again. But then after the movie's over, he obviously returns to be an Admiral again. And so Spock is now in command of the Enterprise. It's basically a training ship. And then stuff happens. Yeah. But Star Trek II leans into the fact that these characters have aged and moved on. And there's that early line, gallivanting around the galaxy is a game for the young. Yeah. And people are like, what's up with that?
Well, like, the Times of London says this about the movie. The emotive finale smartly restates the film's themes of aging and mortality and provides cinema history with the unforgettable tear-jerking line, I have been and always shall be your friend. And you're talking about aging. That one line from Spock, you know, it just kind of like summarizes from 1960. When did it start?
56.
1966 to 1982. They've been friends for that long, if not much longer. And we have been friends with this crew for that long, if not longer. And I, what you just said, this film leaned into aging. Captain Kirk, he has glasses now. His eyes are like allergic to whatever it is that can give him better sight. And the film very, very often refers to aging, the passing of time, what happens. And then at the end, saying goodbye to one of your lifelong friends. Let's talk about that for a second. How effective is this film as a commentary on what happens with a crew? They're together for a long time, the friendship, the band of brothers and sisters. I mean, let's talk about that. How did that strike you?
What definitely hit me, like, certainly more as an adult than it did as a child, just because, you know, I have experienced more of that now. Granted, I'm not old yet, but I'm, you know, I'm not yet 40, but I'm closer to 40 than to 35. So like I've seen a little more of that in my life, like having to move from like one stage or one chapter in life to another. And, you know, having like the friends that I saw in one place that, you know, I don't see them anymore. You know, I've lived, you know, for grad school, I lived in another country. I have lived on different parts of this country, and I've had to say farewell to people at different times. And then sometimes you get those reunions, and there are the friends who become family that you refuse to let go of too. So that's incredibly moving. And also realizing, you know, that not everything that I hoped I would accomplish as a child, am I still going to get done, you know? Some things in my life that I got to live adventurously and go do, you know, there are still adventures out there, but it's not quite the same now. You know, I have a wife and children. I have other responsibilities. My body doesn't heal as easily as it once did. So seeing all that now definitely struck a different chord this time around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tom, what's this film say to you about you and me are circling the same age bracket? So
we're closer in age to each other than we are to Derek.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. Sorry, Derek, I have been your young father.
Very young father, I suppose.
It's interesting that you bring up the crew. The interesting thing about the classic show is even though there is a core crew of characters, the focus is always pretty much on the troika of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And season one of Classic Trek, most people don't realize DeForest Kelly did not have that credit season one. That was added seasons two and three as the writers started leaning into the three of them. Yep. Because using Freudian psychology, I know people don't. Some people think it's out of phase. I think it can be very, very useful. Uh-huh. But Spock functions as the superego, mm-hmm. the brain. McCoy functions as the id, the emotion. And then Kirk is the resulting ego, the balance between the two. Well, the Harry Potter characters work very similarly as well with Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
Yeah.
But the other cast members are always present for adventures, and from time to time they get to move into the foreground. Scotty has a bit bigger role in Star Trek II and more in the director's edition because his Peter Preston, the midshipman who ends up dying in engineering, is Scotty's nephew, which was always in the novelization. And when ABC showed it as a movie of the week, it was put back there. But until Paramount pulling up the cash to let Nicholas Meyer actually do an official director's edition, that was just, I hate to say, apocryphal. I mean, the fans knew, but it has to be on screen. The way Paramount works, and because I've worked in licensing there, it has to be on screen in a movie or an episode to be considered canon. The movies, you know, the animated series does not count. The novels don't count.
So according to Paramount, Savick is not part Romulan.
That has never been established on screen.
Right. Because what I was reading, like, and I don't know if I knew this before, I was like reading up the trivia and IMDb with a lot of stuff that I'm sure you already knew. But apparently, like, she was at least originally written to be part Romulan.
She's supposed to be half Romulan and half.
Yeah, maybe there were some deleted scenes, but that's why in some scenes we see her showing a little bit of emotion, or at least hints of emotion, which, you know, if she were pure Vulcan, she probably wouldn't do that. And she's also a little bit more, I suppose, a little bit more confrontational in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem very Vulcan-like. And, you know, you mentioned that Freudian psychology, but that trichotomy idea is also in, I think it's Aristotle. Is that right? Where it's the three parts of man, essentially. There's the head, the heart, and the belly. And the idea is, you know, or we might think of it as body, soul, and spirit sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's this idea of, like, you know, the head is where you make your, you know, your very logical decisions. It's more academic. The heart is more like the emotional and sometimes the moral decisions. The belly is more just like, you know, your gut instinct.
Gut instinct.
Your body. And you see that, like, he's Bones is called Bones because he's like the body Kirk. The name actually means church. So he's kind of the moral center for the three. And that's why he's kind of the leader. And you see that similarly with Harry, Ron, and Hermione. Hermione's the brain, Harry's the heart, and Ron is the gut.
Emotion.
Yep. Yeah.
So let's dig into a little bit to the plot. So the plot basically, and Tom, can you explain the Genesis plot and how that's the impetus for moving this story forward, just to kind of
it's the MacGuffin. Yeah. A former girlfriend of Kirk's, Carol Marcus, has created with her son Project Genesis, which is the device that it's meant to make terraforming easier. So you can take a barren planetoid, you know, explode the Genesis device over it, and then it'll turn into Eden. Fun fact, if you watch the second pilot for Star Trek, Where No Man Has Gone Before, Gary Mitchell, Kirk's Academy classmate, talks about a little blonde lab tech he threw Kirk's way.
Oh.
And so a lot of fans have speculated that that was a reference to Carol Marcus back in the original series. What happens is that Chekhov is on a different ship, the Reliant, with Paul Winfield as commanding officer, Commander Terrell, and they're on CD Alpha. Is it six?
They're on six. Oh no! They think they're on six.
They're headed for CD Alpha six.
They're headed for CD Alpha six, and it turns out that Chekhov, who was not on screen first season of Star Trek because he was not on the show. But Chekhov sees Botany Bay and realizes, rut-roll. And then by the time he tries to beat Feet, Khan and his gang appear. His gang of eugenically enhanced supermen appear. And Khan is wondering why they're there, which is how he finds out about Project Genesis. And so he, of course, is going to steal it. And, you know, basically this is going to force Kirk to confront his old flame, who's also his baby mama.
We find out that Kirk's got a son. But, like, what's the thing that's so simple about, and I was watching it just the other night with some friends, the thing that was so simple about the plot, it was just a grudge match and a stand.
Revenge.
One man against another man, one force against another force, and the most beautiful, like, I forgot how beautiful the standoff between the two ships was in the nebula, just going one after one another, and it was simple. It was so simple. I thought, because I misremembered some of the plot points, mixed up some of the other movies into this one. Then when I'm watching, I'm like, wow, this is it. And it's great. Like, the simplicity of the plot was fantastic. I just love the way they went after each other. Khan just trying to force Kirk's hand, trying to get revenge on him. It was fantastic. It was fantastic. Hey, let me ask you this. There is a little bit of a controversy, not a controversy. Chekhov never saw Khan, right, in the original series.
He was not on season one of Star Trek.
Yeah. But
they put him on the series because the Russians were not happy that Star Trek has all these, you know, different ethnicities in space. It's like, we were the first in space. What the frick? So that and the fact that the monkeys and the Beatles were hot, and so they wanted a younger character with a cool haircut.
Okay. Because like in this movie, when he sees Khan and when Khan sees him, they recognize each other, but they've never seen each other. Can you explain how Star Trek got around that?
He was in engineering. Yeah, that's it. He was in engineering.
So he probably would have seen him. I mean, he was on Enterprise, just not on camera.
Yeah. And also interesting part, you talked about the Genesis device, which is a device which creates life from deadness, life out of nothing. When they demonstrate how it creates the planet, that new planet, that was one of the first films to have a fully CGI rendered sequence. And it was really cool for the day. I remember seeing that. And
cutting edge for 2002.
Yep. Go ahead. Same year that Tron came out.
Which was 1982. Jeez, right. 2002.
Oh, what did you say?
I said 2002. Cutting edge for 1982.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, we're going to leave the big sequence at the end, the big, you know, the Spock scene out. Talk about a couple of scenes or one or two scenes in particular that stood out from you from this film and why so. Derek, we'll go with you first.
Well, I mean, as a kid, I was always really disturbed by the seedy eels, because that freaked me out. I mean, now I see it and I'm like, okay, that ear looks really fake. But at the time, just seeing that and this creepy bug worm thing climbing into a guy's ear and then making him crazy just gave me the heebie-jeebies. Didn't bother me quite so much this time around, but it used to a lot. I'm trying to think what else. The whole concept of Genesis, I always thought was really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And now just thinking of that thematically and in the scheme of the broader movie where, you know, we're talking about aging and how we all face death. And here is this, you know, technology that's creating, like bringing about life, on a dead planet. It's just, I don't know. I think it's really cool how that all sort of ties together. And I think it's part of what makes this movie really strong. I also remember Kirstie Alley. I remember seeing, it said introducing Kirstie Alley, which I thought was kind of cool.
It was almost Kim Cattrall.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. Right, Tom? They had a spotlight. They had kind of chosen Kim Cattrall for the part, but then they went with Kirstie Alley. Did I know something Tom didn't know?
If Tom doesn't know, it's probably not true.
I hadn't heard that before. However, Kim Cattrall plays Valeris in Star Trek VI. Yep. Evidently, they wanted to get Kirstie Alley back for Star Trek VI to play Savick. Why they didn't ask Robin Curtis, who was in Star Trek III and IV, is the recast of Savick, I'll not know. But and some people were glad they didn't because it would have ruined Savick as a character. And of course, we never saw her again anyway. So what difference does it make?
Isn't this where we first learned about the Kobayashi Maru?
This is the first mention appearance of the Kobayashi Maru, the classic no-win situation, which has since been used in many of the Star Trek shows.
Yeah,
and in the 11th film, the JJ reboot.
Yeah, if you want to talk about those new ones.
No, we're going to mention them. We'll mention them here towards the end.
Yeah.
Do we have to?
I'm not as much of a hater of those films, guys. But
I like the first one. I despise the second one. The third one's just, it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I have some mixed feelings. The first one I really liked. The second one I had a lot of fun watching in the theater. Same with the third one. But they're not movies that I would need to watch again.
Yeah. Well, since we brought this up, and wait, Derek, were you finished with yours? I'm sorry.
Just the Kobayashi Maru. I was like, oh yeah, I use that, you know, in conversation sometimes, and I have to explain to people what it means.
All right, Tom, let's hear yours.
For my scenes,
yeah,
I love the ship battle. It was pretty much Meyer patterned it after submarine warfare.
Nice. Oh, of course.
Because, you know, in real life, submarines don't have big, huge picture windows like the sea view on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. So you are just, you're kind of flying blind, not flying blind, but you only have sonar. And the thing with sonar is, I was anti-submarine warfare officer on my ship. You don't want to use your sonar actively because if you ping, everybody knows where you are. So it's a matter of trying to figure out where the other person is through, and there's all kinds of techniques and a variety of means to do that. But the Mutaro Nebula sequence is terrific, especially when there's the graphic when basically the two ships are in opposite orbit around the same planet. But somebody, I think Spock notes that Khan's maneuvering is all two-dimensional. And you, of course, have, you know, height as well as width and depth. So that's how they win. So many things that Nicholas Meyer, one of the pitches, one of Gene Roddenberry's pitches for Star Trek, I mean, the two basic ones were Horatio Hornblower in space and Wagon Train to the Stars. And it was great that Meyer went back to the Horatio Hornblower in space. That's one of the reasons why they redesigned the uniforms for this movie to make them a little bit more military-like. The costumes for Star Trek One, they're like polyester leisure suits. Yeah, it's the late 70s, but still, man, they're like pajamas.
Oh my gosh! Hey, can you talk a little bit about this film? Is a lot of folks consider like this film to be the first of a trilogy, the Spock trilogy? Yes. Yes.
It's been marketed that way too.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I went back and thought about it. I was like, yeah, this is the Spock trilogy. And was this in the plans early on? Because I heard that Leonard Nimoy wanted his character killed off, and that's how they got him back.
Yes, you are correct. That is not just a rumor. Leonard Nimoy wanted out, and he wanted his character to be killed off,
which was a shock.
And then he had a change of heart as they were wrapping. And then the decision was made. There's basically the shot of his coffin on the Genesis planet.
Yep.
The scene where he does the mind meld with McCoy and says, remember.
Yep.
And then him doing the Space the Final Frontier voiceover at the end of the film. So yeah. All subtle clues that he'll be back.
The needs of the many outweigh
the needs of the few.
Or the one. I never took the Kobayashi Maru test. Until now. What do you think of my solution? Spock. I have been, and always shall be, your friend. Live long and prosper.
Of course, it's funny because Star Trek III is the search for Spock, but where he really was in the director's chair.
Well, that because he directed Spock III, right?
He directed Star Trek III and IV. And unfortunately, Shatner leveraged that to direct Star Trek V. And the less said about that, the better. Although Strange New Worlds is giving some well-needed backstory to one of the plot elements of Star Trek V. Initially I kind of wished that they had kept Spock dead just so the show could move on. But I mean, the franchise is really Kirk, Spock, McCoy, so you really need that troika. So when they lean into the trilogy, three becomes about finding Spock, who, you know, has been reborn thanks to Genesis.
Yep. There you go.
The last effects of the Genesis wave. And then Star Trek IV becomes this comic romp in 1986 San Francisco, which
loved it.
The first time I saw IV, I was like, and then I've grown to love it over the years.
Yeah. Oh, you weren't a fan at first?
Not a fan at first. I saw it on VHS when I was stationed overseas, and I just thought, sacrilege, you're making fun of my... But...
Oh my gosh, I just remember that was when Spock was having to learn to cuss. that was the funniest.
And I love that they brought back Mark Lenard as Sarek in 3 and 4, but specifically they brought back Jane Wyatt to play Amanda Grayson in 4, because we had not seen her since Journey to Baybel season 2 of the original series.
Yeah.
And that character gets a lot more love, well, except for when they killed her off in Star Trek 11. But she recurred on the first, second season of Star Trek Discovery.
So much stuff. So, do you think that, so this works well as a trilogy? Is Khan the best of the three?
Oh yeah, definitely.
What elevates it?
Wrath of Khan is my favorite of the 13 Star Trek movies.
It's the favorite of many people's.
And I've seen it the most times. I went to a screening at the Egyptian. There was a dude who worked on the movie sitting in the same row of us. And I think he was like, kind of like, oh my gosh, this dude knows. I wasn't the only one, but people know the lines. It's almost like Rocky Horror.
Yeah. Derek, where does Star Trek II fall within your pantheon of Star Trek films?
That's tough. Because for me, like, I'll go back and rewatch a big series like this and I'll pick different favorites along the way. But I think my number one favorite will always be First Contact.
Huh.
Partly because I grew up more with the Next Generation crew.
That was your introduction to Star Trek.
And Data, you know, I'm a lifelong Data fan. He's, you know, he's my favorite character of, I think, any franchise out there. But yeah, like, as far as the original series crew, this might be my favorite. I need to rewatch some of the others, though, because it's been a long time for some of those. I was always a big fan of number 6, The Undiscovered Country.
You were or were not?
I was.
Well, Meyer returns to direct, and he co-wrote the script for that. And I thought it was fascinating that it's actually kind of the first Next Generation tie-in movie, because you have Colonel Worf, Worf's ancestor in the movie, played by Michael Dorn. And also they leaned into the fact of the real world, what was going on as the Soviet Union changed and was becoming less antagonistic towards the United States. So does the Klingon Empire become less antagonistic toward, you know, and the destruction of the moon of Kronos parallels the nuclear accident. I'm thinking Chernobyl.
Chernobyl, yeah.
Interesting.
So that was kind of an inspiration for that.
I've really got to rewatch it.
Well, is Undiscovered Country, which is the one, because one of my favorite scenes from all of Star Trek is probably in one of the worst Star Trek, well, one of the most poorly received Star Trek films. I think it was the one where they go searching for God.
That's five.
What's the name of the movie?
Final Frontier.
Is that the one when, talking about mortality, like towards the end of the movie, it's almost like they're sitting around a campfire at the end, just
row your boat.
Yeah, there was something about that scene that was so comforting and so familiar and so like, this, it felt like the end of the Star Trek series right there. They ended it, you know, like some things end with a kaboom. And that felt like the spotlight on the stage had gone smaller and smaller and smaller until it's finally out. It felt like a soft close to Star Trek, but they kept going.
Of course.
I love that scene. And that's why Star Trek II, that I felt like they had a little bit of that kind of a feeling of the friendship. Like, talk for a minute about, you call it the trio, the Trioka, Troika. How the Star Trek II is really the film that kind of grabbed that and moved that relationship with those three forward, especially then the next one where one of the Troika, Bones, had to carry the mind of Spock and he just hated it. But like, can you talk about that a minute? Just the relationship between the three and how this is the film that kind of really captured that.
The thing that I love about the relationship between the three characters is, even though Spock and McCoy are often at odds, they have a very deep friendship.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I talk about this with my screenwriting students a lot. It's the situation where you have two friends, where one person has two friends whose only connection is that person, and when he's not around, those two people often have no relationship or a very antagonistic relationship. But the thing is, over the years, I mean, they, both, each of them, McCoy and Spock, know how to get each other's under each other's skin, but they also know each other really well. Mm-hmm. And I just love some of the best zingers in the movie when they show the Genesis film, you know, the briefing about what the Genesis project is, and McCoy's like, you know, according to myth, the, you know, God made the world in 6 days. Well, now Genesis can do it in 6 minutes. And Spock is just on him, and it's just, I love that. I mean, it really feels like a lived-in friendship. And again, Kirk's playing referee between these two.
Yeah.
And the irony is, like you said, in Star Trek III, Spock's parting gift was to put his soul in McCoy.
Of all people.
Possibly suspecting that, you know, that there might be a way to bring himself back. But yeah, or if nothing else, return to Vulcan and take care of it.
Hmm. So was that, do you think that scene when he put his soul in, because I didn't notice that scene the first couple of times I saw Star Trek II in the summer of 1982, I saw it 3 times in theaters. I was one of the people who helped push it to its $97 million gross. But
which was a lot of money back then.
I know, 1982, $100 million back then for a Star Trek film, especially since the first one had all but disappeared upon arrival. But do you think you were talking about how, like, as Leonard Nimoy was as the film was progressing, that's when he changed his mind. When did they write in the mind meld scene at the very end? Because it looked like it was just thrown in. And when I saw it this time or the last time, I was like, was that in the original film? But it was in the original
film. It was, right? In the original film.
So they were planning on this being a trilogy when they wrote it.
Well, not when they originally wrote it, but as things progress, I mean, everybody rolls with the punches.
Yeah.
People roll with the punches. I want to say that the mind meld might have been a pickup shot that was shot after most of the principal photography was done. I mean, it's not that hard to do.
Yeah, it seemed like it could have been.
Yeah.
And it did seem like, at the very least, they were trying to lay hints and just put some groundwork down for something they could do for the next movie, you know.
Yeah. What's really interesting, though, is as unsettling as Spock's death is and as satisfying as his resurrection is, the thing that shook a lot of people is the destruction of the Enterprise.
In part 3.
In Search for Spock. It's like, as we go through part 4 in The Stolen Bird of Prey.
Right.
And the comic books, because DC had the license at the time, they had to have them in the Bird of Prey until the next movie came out so they could get to the Enterprise A.
Yep.
But yeah, it's they're kind of winging it. They're kind of winging it because Nimoy made it part of his deal that he got to direct 3 for him to come back for 3.
Yeah.
So it's just Ralph Winter once said at I think it was an Act 1 screenwriting conference.
Who is Ralph Winter?
Say what?
Who is Ralph Winter?
Ralph Winter is a veteran Hollywood producer who worked on Star Trek 2 through 6.
Oh, did not know
that. And also X-Men 1 through 4.
Yep.
But he remarked at a conference once that every creative decision has financial consequences and every financial decision has creative consequences. And this is an example where Nimoy leveraged his return contingent on him being able to direct.
Okay.
It's interesting how reticent people were to let actors direct back then. That's why Ron Howard quit Happy Days. Because he wanted to be able to write and direct, and they said no. And he said, bye.
Yep. I remember when Richie left. It was so sad.
Roger.
You mentioned Ralph Winter was on this and also on the X-Men movies, because I was thinking earlier about how the end of this movie reminded me so much of X-Men 2, which obviously this came first, but it was like, oh, X-Men 2 is really pulling hard from this, from the looks of things, because
a lot of people pull hard from this, including Into Darkness, but the less said about that, the better.
Yeah.
Nope. We're going to say something about it. Into Darkness, J.J. Abrams retake kind of on this film, which kind of. Derek, because I think Thomas might heave-ho if I ask him to describe a little bit about Into Darkness. What was this film? I mean, if you can, a quick plot recap.
It's basically a remix of Star Trek II. And the problem is, when Benedict Cumberbatch is the antagonist and they kept his identity a secret, Gary Mitchell would have been a better choice personally. But when he finally, I saw a preview screening of this with a friend, and at the moment in the film, he stands up and says, "I'm Khan." And I felt like standing up and saying, "Sit down, white boy. Khan is a Mexican playing a swarthy Latina."
Right?
Is a Latino playing a swarthy Indian?
Yeah. Let's talk about... So, there was one good thing about that movie. And I do it the same. The J.J. Abrams remake. I loved... I mean, I didn't dislike it probably as much as you guys did. But it gave us the great moment of when old school Spock in another timeline was able to warn this current timeline crew of the Enterprise, beware of Khan. He has done very bad things, including he killed him. You know, that I think that was kind of a really good scene there. Not the rest of the movie wasn't so great, but that was
I mean, that was cool. And there were some fun, like, just moments in the theater of just seeing, like, you know, some big ships fighting and stuff. But other than that, part of what was so compelling about Khan as a villain in this movie is Kirk had forgotten about him. They went back to this one episode from the first season of the show that a lot of people wouldn't have remembered. And the idea was, oh, this guy that was not important to you has not forgotten you. And he has been driven mad. Like, the only thing driving him is getting his revenge. And that's what was so interesting. There was some irony there because it wasn't that important to Kirk to remember it, you know. I mean, not that everybody had forgotten, but it was, you know, it was a single episode. It was one moment among many. And it wasn't like he was some huge villain in the original series. It was surprise. This guy that you thought wasn't going to matter again has come back. And so it seemed when they were trying to do it for Into Darkness, they were trying to play on the nostalgia factor and do the fan service, but lost thematically why that villain was so compelling. Because now, bringing him up here, there was no revenge factor. It was just he was this super smart, genetically enhanced character that woke up from cryosleep and for some reason was angry.
And the fact that the sacrifice works because these characters have known each other for decades, whereas in the new Trek timeline, in the Kelvin timeline, they barely met each other and don't like each other that much.
And
not to mention thematically, the whole thing about that sacrifice fits in where this movie, like, you start off at the beginning where he says, how we deal with life is as important as how we deal with death. That's the theme of the movie. So of course, like, if you're going to deal with that and then you have one of your major characters sacrificing himself to save everyone else, like, that's the biggest answer to, like, okay, how should we face death? It is you find something in you to survive by being driven by love rather than wrath or vengeance, you know? And so it worked in the broader theme of the movie. Into Darkness was not about that.
Nope.
You just said the perfect summary of what my question was going to be was, why was the death of Spock in Star Trek II Wrath of Khan so momentous? I mean, for one thing, it was a beloved character, but why did it work so well in the themes of this movie, and why to this day is it remembered? Why do we remember that? It's one of the most, you know, shocking but, like, heartbreaking scenes of all time for those of us.
Kirk has never accepted a no-win scenario. The way he got through the Kobayashi Maru was he cheated. He reprogrammed the simulator. Mm-hmm. So he ends up having to face it because his best friend sacrifices himself. You know, the good of the many outweighs the good of the few or the one. And even though, the last words and pop, there's a pop of this at Target I want to buy because it's Kirk and Spock in engineering at the end, ship out of danger. You know, I have been and always shall be your friend. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. You know, Kirk is thrust. You've always cheated death, but sooner or later you're going to have to deal. And he does because his bestie has sacrificed to save the ship.
Yep. Where was the phrase, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one? Didn't they turn that phrase on its ear later in one of the
They do in Star Trek III.
Okay. The needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many. Yeah, and I just thought that was so clever the way they kept that phrase and they made it another touching moment later when they're all sacrificing everything to save Spock. Was it to save Spock? Yeah.
Is it Spock?
Gosh, that was so good. Thematically, that just worked so well. I do have another question. We're going to have to start wrapping up. We could talk about this all night. But so here's one of the quotes from one of the critics. It's Ricardo Montalban's physical threat and very real sense of menace that gives Wrath of Khan its propulsive narrative and addictive quality that keeps you coming back time and time again. Derek, you were talking about how Benedict Cumberbatch, who is an actor I love.
He's great.
In the right role.
His Khan didn't hold a candle to the original Khan. What was it about Ricardo Montalban's Khan that makes him one of the top villains of all time?
Well, it was what we were talking about earlier, for one. The fact that, we wouldn't have expected to see this character ever again, but he shows up, and he's been living this all this time, plotting his revenge, essentially. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, Ricardo Montalban is pretty iconic. It's kind of hard to replace that with, this white British guy. You know, it's like a totally different look, totally different style. So if you're going to do that, just have a different villain, you know? Yeah. I think it would have been so much smarter to go back to some other episode in the original series that we had completely forgotten about and taken some other interesting villain somewhere else if they were going to bring somebody back. And then thematically, it would have been like Wrath of Khan in a much better way, something much more effective. But, people don't always think about theme and character when they're making movies these days. It's more about how big of a universe can we make and how, giant of things can we put on screen.
They recast Khan. They rebooted Khan. It'd kind of be kind of like, recasting or rebooting Darth Vader. We wouldn't. We did do that. Listen, what?
Or recasting Obi-Wan. Oh, we did that too.
But okay, Obi-Wan's not so bad. So Tom, what is it? Why is Khan so effective as a villain and so memorable?
Ricardo Montalban. He is just, there's no rich Corinthian leather on the Reliant. But no, there's just dude's got swagger.
Yeah.
Dude's got swagger, and like I mentioned before, he can choose scenery. He can devour scenery as much as Shatner can, but because they're so evenly matched, and those were his real pecs. He would do push-ups.
I was going to ask you. Takes. Just like, I read that they were the real ones. I was wondering if you believed
he did push-ups in between takes. I mean, the dude, because he was not a spring chicken at the time, right. But dude's in shape. I wouldn't go against him.
Was he still on Fantasy Island at the time?
Yes.
They worked filming around his schedule for
Fantasy Island. Because Mr. Rourke was not a big, muscular guy. He was more, kind of like the Island Butler almost. There's no other way to describe
the Island Butler.
Apparently, according to the IMDb trivia, a lot of Khan's henchmen were Chippendale dancers at the time.
Oh, that's funny.
Because all they had to do in this was just kind of stand in the background and look muscular,
Flex.
Yeah.
So here's a question. The bottom line is, from another review, is what happened. They returned to the things that made the series so successful for so long. And Tom, I talked to you, you were talking about some other topic. What's the newest Star Trek series?
Strange New Worlds.
It goes back to the secret sauce, the stuff that made Star Trek what it is, and how Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, it goes back, it goes back to what makes Star Trek what is Star Trek. It's intelligence, outwitting, it's outsmarting your enemy. It's not blowing them up all the time. There's some of that as well.
Also what I like about First Contact. There's a lot of great blowing up the bad guys stuff, but there's also outsmarting them and friends sticking by each other and sacrificing for each other.
I mean, like part two, it's epitomized in the secret communication between Spock and Jim Kirk, where they're talking to each other. And can you remember the scene when they're communicating to one another, but in code, when they're back and forth on walkie-talkie?
Like yeah.
And how, Kirstie Alley's character, what's her name again? She goes, you lied. He goes, I exaggerated to Spock. Could Tom, can you talk about the secret sauce of Star Trek and why this film so well exemplified it?
One of the fun things, you mentioned Savick, one of the fun things is they bring this outsider character, Spock's clear protege, in to observe the situation. And this is why you need Star Trek One. The Spock of Star Trek One, the Spock of the series, is trying to excise his human part and trying to bury it. The Spock of Star Trek Two has learned from the V'ger encounter, I am both human and Vulcan. I need both halves of myself to be complete. So he's comfortable in his own skin, which allows him to be a great captain, which allows him to do the things that he needs to be, which allows him to say, hey, Jim, the ship's yours. You shouldn't have been promoted anyway. You know that. And right. I have no ego, so I don't really care.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, these are people who've known each other for decades and know each other really well. I mean, we all have friends in our lives who in many respects know us better, in some respects know us better than we know ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it's always kind of, sometimes it takes, we think we know ourselves better, but the thing is we don't look at ourselves from the outside. And that's what I love about these, especially the Power Three, you know, the Troika, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, they know each other really well, and they know each other. You know, McCoy gives them eyeglasses. Why? He's allergic to Retinax 5 or whatever the drug is.
Yeah.
And Spock gives Kirk the Enterprise to command. Because why? Because he knows his first best destiny is as a starship captain, not as a desk jockey.
Yeah.
I mean, and it returns to those core relationships. The first movie, yeah, it had a lot of interesting heady ideas and cool special effects, but at the end of the day, nobody cares about cool special effects. It's the relationships between the people. And that's the one thing that Strange New Worlds has gotten completely right, is they get that these people, that the Enterprise crew is a family. You know, the captain is the surrogate father generally, and then the other characters are either siblings or proteges, you know, nieces and nephews, etc. But together they form a community which can take on all manners of threats.
I think it's interesting how when you look at the original crew movies versus the Next Generation movies, in the Next Generation films, I mean, I'm not sure about the timeline, if it's that much later from the TV series anyway, but you don't really see the characters moving on because they're all still together on the Enterprise.
Yep.
And it's interesting, like, some of that might have to do with the amount of time that's passed, but some of it also is the fact that in Generations, when Kirk and Picard meet in the Nexus, Kirk is talking to Picard and he says, oh, you've been at this a while, you're thinking about retirement. He's like, oh, I've thought of it. And Kirk says, don't do it.
Don't
let them promote you. Don't let them do anything that can take you away from the bridge of that ship, because while you're there, you can make a difference. And you see, like, with Kirk, he went on and became an admiral, and he's always, you know, he misses being just in the captain's chair. We see it over and over again, even with Generations. So many of the movies just bring him back onto the bridge again and have to find ways to do that to get the crew back together. But with Picard, like, it's like that sticks with him, I guess, and he doesn't want to leave the chair. And then so it's very interesting, you know, some of the things that happen with the Picard series later. But I did like that, and it was interesting, like, being more familiar with those films and watching this one again, how you see that connection. You're like, oh yeah, this is why Kirk said that, because he, you know, is always hating the fact that he's not there himself, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah. There's so much to love in all of this. And I really just want to watch all of the movies again.
I do too. And as we wrap, I do have, like,
but I have to sleep and eat, you know,
I know there's that
really human stuff.
Yeah.
And take care of the kids.
Yes.
But one of the things that I'm always struck by in almost every Star Trek iteration, whether it's the film, the series, or whatnot, and it has to do with the Vulcans, the Data, usually the Vulcans, is that it's all about what is humanity. And it's somebody trying to understand and get a better grasp on humanity and be a better human, no matter what species they are in the universe. And even like Worf in Next Generation. But I remember, was it Tosh? Who was the actress who was killed by the tar monster?
Armis, Denise Crosby, Bing's granddaughter.
Oh, yeah. I remember when she was giving her special salute to Data in those that early season of Next Generations, that she was admiring his search for humanity and trying to be human. Picard loves Data, who is one of the most human people he's met. And then, Tom, what was it that James T. Kirk said about his friend Spock in his closing
of remark? All of us, he was the most chokes up human.
And it choked me up too, rewatching. I knew what he was about to say, and I started choking him up. Why does that strike us so deeply, and why is that so important to the heart of Star Trek?
Because the tagline for the first movie was "The human adventure is just beginning." At the end of the day, the exploration of space is a metaphor for the explanation of our humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is very humanistic. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Star Trek has always been in one way about this positive view of the future, being very optimistic about, you know, where things could go. And that was part of what I loved about it as a kid. As an adult, I'm much more pessimistic about human beings. But yeah, there's also, like, you know, just from the Christian perspective, we are made in God's image. There is common grace, and everybody, you know, has a sense of right and wrong. I mean, there are even lines in the Bible about, you know, like the truth. What's the line? Eternity is written on our hearts. There is like a craving there for something greater. And I think Star Trek speaks to that too. You know, yeah. We have a sense of knowing how things should be, even if we can't quite get ourselves there. Mm-hmm. And that is really interesting, because when we talk about what it really means to be human, I mean, if we think from, like, you know, I can't speak with like a lot of other religious ideologies, but from a Christian perspective, you know, thinking before the fall would be what would be truly human. And that would be a point where we really could love completely, where mm-hmm. we're not being selfish, where we would be willing to sacrifice for one another, and not necessarily even give it a second thought. Where we could balance that, the emotion and the logic, and make the right decisions. And I think Star Trek speaks to that wish in all of us to be better, and to hope that, you know, the rest of humanity would be better too.
Yeah. And I think it does. Like, I do share the Christian background, but I do think the themes of Star Trek are very broad across all belief systems. The hopefulness for what is ahead and for what's better. And I love that, you know, the 5-year mission to go where no man, no woman, no person has ever gone before. And they're just searching for something to make, you know, humanity better, to make living better, to make culture better. And I love that about Star Trek. I could talk about this forever. This is just so great. Tom, why don't you wrap us up with just some of the best, most hopeful ideas from Star Trek II, and how it takes us, how they translate to the rest of the Star Trek universe.
There's a great line. There's a line from the first season finale of Star Trek Next Generation, The Neutral Zone. And the Enterprise D comes across people in suspended animation, and who are just surprised how things are in the 24th century. And Picard says, "We have eliminated war, want, hunger, need." And so, hopefully, if we can get out of our infancy as a species, we can, you know, develop a more egalitarian society where truly every person is considered equal, mm-hmm. not just based on race, creed, politics, color, etc.
Amen to that. Who knew that Star Trek was so deep? Who knew? We knew. Hey. Thank you guys so much. I can't think of two people I would rather talk about Star Trek than the two of you. So real quick, Derek, where can people find you if they want to talk Star Trek?
Well, you can try and reach me on Twitter at ConGuyDerek. I will admit, as I often do, I'm not on Twitter very often.
You're an in-person kind of guy.
I know. I would much rather talk in person. But if you show up for the Con Guy show, you can message us while we're talking. You can reach out in the comments on theconguy.com. Always excited to start a conversation.
Mm-hmm. And Tom?
You can reach me on Twitter and Instagram at blurredphd. And I launched a new podcast, Screen Tom.
Mm.
Screen with Tom, T-H-O-M, and the next episode I'm going to be recording is going to be called Seeing Stars, talking about the Star Wars franchise on Disney Plus, as well as the Star Trek series on Paramount Plus.
How appropriate. How appropriate. I love that. And Tom, you're going to be at Comic-Con, right? San Diego Comic-Con?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Are you doing a panel?
I am on a panel for the Christian Comics Art Society.
Fantastic. Oh, good. All right, guys. I will see,
we'll see you there.
We will both see you down there at San Diego Comic-Con. And that's it for tonight. Remember, you can always catch us here at theconguide.com. It's been so great to talk about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, as we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the year of 1982, one of the best years ever for movies. Talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.
Live long and prosper.
Thanks for listening to The Con Guy Show, the official program of theconguy.com. Find us on the Weeby Geeks Collective or anywhere you listen to podcasts. And now on sci-fi.radio, Saturdays at 4 o'clock Eastern, 1 o'clock Pacific, both AM and PM. That's 9 o'clock Greenwich. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.